Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're doing our second installment of Five Albums That Made Me. This time we're talking with Dean Wareham of Galaxy 500 and Luna, to name a few of his musical projects.
Oh, you got it, Greg. Dean is probably best known for his work in those two bands, Galaxy 500 and Luna, but he has also released albums with his wife under the name Dean and Britta, and under his own name, including last year's I Have Nothing to Say to the Mayor of L.A. He was born in New Zealand, lived in Australia, then his family settled in New York City in 1977. I mean, what a time to arrive.
Yeah, good time.
Center of the musical universe, and he's a high school student in New York.
Oh, yeah, Jim. I mean, it was an unbelievable scene. Wareham went to prep school and then Harvard, where he met his future Galaxy 500 bandmates, Damon Krukowski and Naomi Yang, who have also appeared on our show.
Absolutely.
Post-Galaxy 500 guys, as Damon and Naomi. But Galaxy 500 made three great studio albums and then imploded. There was internal tensions within the band. But those three records, you know, a parallel can be drawn to bands like the Velvet Underground or Big Star, where they kind of codified a movement before anybody could put a name on it. You know, people later on started calling it slowcore and things like that. But they created this moody, atmospheric vibe with just guitar, bass, and drums. And it was beautiful, haunting, and there was, at the same time, a sort of a depth to it that was more than just this beautiful sound. But there was a sadness, a melancholy, an introspection there. They brought layers and layers of musicality and meaning to what they were doing. And, you know, a band like Low, for example.
Right, wouldn't
coming
exist.
Coming straight out of that scene. So incredibly influential band, incredibly important band.
Well, and then the big second act that Wareham had, you know, it's the beginning of the alternative era. Bands that had forged a path in the indie underground or getting signed to the major labels. 1991, Dean Wareham puts together Luna. You know, at various times, Luna included such fellow indie rock superstars as Stan Demesky of the Feelies, Justin Harwood of the Chills. But in his book and in interviews, you know, Dean says basically his entire musical career, the roots of that sound can all be heard in the first Galaxy 500 single, Tugboat, which I always heard, and many people did. Dean was coy for years about its real meaning. I always heard it as being about Sterling Morrison, the great Velvet Underground rhythm guitarist. After making four of the most important albums in rock history, most influential recordings, you know, splits the band, Lou Reed becomes Lou Reed, and Sterling is a tugboat captain who really nobody heard from for years until the short-lived Velvet Underground reunion, except he did play on some Luna tracks.
Mm-hmm. In 1999, Britta Phillips joined Luna and became a romantic partner with Dean. After Luna broke up, they started recording as Dean and Britta, doing some soundtrack work, notably for Noah Brumbach's The Squid and the Whale. And eventually, in 2013, they moved out to Los Angeles, which explains the title of his recent solo album.
You know, Greg, a couple of weeks ago, I got to do a wonderful session for the Old Town School of Folk Music here in Chicago with a musician I've been a fan of since the 80s. And we had such a wonderful chat, Dean Wareham and I. And while I've mentioned his duo, Dean and Britta, several times, and we've played Galaxy 500, I think we've played Luna on the show, we've never had Dean Wareham on the show. And we were like, hey, this is one of the most enthusiastic music fans, funniest, smartest guys we know. We're fans. We've got to rectify this. So Dean is going to follow in the prestigious footsteps of Amy Mann. We figured, let's talk five records that shaped me with Dean Wareham. Dean, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you for having me. I know you've only been doing that. You haven't been doing this for long, so you know.
Yeah, no, only a couple decades. You know? nor have you been doing it for that long.
No, yeah.
You know, Dean, of course, was the driving force of Galaxy 500, of Luna. As I mentioned, Dean and Britta, the duo with his wife, several solo albums, including the one that came out in October, which is really great, about hoping to be able to sell out. Finally, in cash.
Oh, yes, yes.
I say that sarcastically.
Where's that line you joined a sellout? I want to know where that is so I can join it too.
It's not selling out, it's cashing in.
Were minor chords. No major six or B diminished. All my rewards are just rewards. I'm not selling out, I'm cashing in.
And a great memoir, too, in 2009, Black Postcards, where you talk about your love of music, Dean, throughout your life. So we figured you'd be the perfect person to play this. This is like the expanded Desert Island Jukebox, five albums that shaped me. Where are you going to start?
Let's go chronologically in the order in which I purchased these albums, shall we? So I'm going to start with VU Live 69, the Velvet Underground Live 1969, whatever it's called.
Yes, 1969 Velvet Underground Live. It's had different titles with that incredibly cheesy girl in the fishnets from the waist down.
Yeah, that was the only misstep on that record. 1974, it was posthumously released, so to speak. The Velvets had broken up. So, Dean, how did you discover this record?
You know, I think at that point, that was the only Velvet Underground record in print. So if I would go down to Disco Mat at Grand Central Station looking for a Velvet Underground record, maybe Loaded was in print. But if you wanted to hear live, any Velvet Underground, it was pretty much Live 69. Or you could hear Rock and Roll Animal, the Lou Reed album, if you wanted to get a taste of those songs. But that's a very different thing.
Completely different animal.
But yeah, so this album, half of it is at the Matrix in San Francisco, and now it's, you know, all those recordings are available, remixed. That's pretty great, true, all the Matrix. But then half of it is from some club at the end of Cole Avenue in Dallas, Texas, and Lou Reed tells a story about it, having gone to see the Cowboys that day.
I think your Cowboys won today, didn't they? Yeah.
But it's
just
like,
give people a little chance.
And we saw your Cowboys today, and they... Never let Philadelphia have the ball for a minute. It's 42-7 back by the half. It was ridiculous.
You've probably seen the new Velvet Underground documentary about them. Mm-hmm. If I'm to nitpick that movie, which I will do, it's that not enough credit is paid to the Doug Yule period of the band. So after Lou Reed dumps John Cale and has sends Sterling Morrison to do it. And they get Doug Yule, and they turn into a really, like, fantastic live band. And I think that sort of the cacophony, the noise and the drone and the, and you know, maybe some of the experimentation departs with Cale, but they still turn into this really great live band. And I looked this up actually the weekend they're recording at the Matrix in San Francisco. The Rolling Stones are recording at Madison Square Garden, the album that becomes Get Your Ya-Ya's
Out.
Oh, man,
yeah.
I like that record too, but this Live 69, it just sounds so fantastic. It sounds like you're in the room.
Well, it's the real Velvet Lover's choice, Dean.
Yeah.
I put together a book a couple of years ago. I was the editor. I wrote an introductory essay. Mr. Cott contributed. And I turned to some of my favorite writers, you know, on the Velvets. And you were the first one I called, and you chose this record. Because the rhythms and the tightness of that band and the kind of vamping on these songs and expanding them, and I don't want to say, I'm trying to avoid saying jamming, you know, because they were never a
really
jam
jamming,
band.
Yeah.
It's not jamming; it's rhythmic workouts.
Yes, exactly. That's what's amazing. Yeah, that long version of What Goes On. You just it goes on forever and ever.
Doug Yule and Sterling, you know, because Sterling never gets as much credit. And, man, just the rhythmic interplay.
He was not someone with a big ego and not someone to toot his own horn, I think. But and he departed the band. That was the other strange thing about the film. It made it seem like Sterling Morrison quits the band before Lou Reed does. But, in fact, it's the other way around. Lou quits after those disappointing shows at Max's Kansas City. And then Sterling quits when they're going on tour without Lou Reed, and he goes to the airport with an empty suitcase and says, you know what, I'm not coming.
I was flashing on when you told the Disco Matt anecdote, because I'm living across the river in Jersey and coming into record shop in Manhattan. You know, there was that period where the only Velvets music you saw in bins was 69 Live, and the record the Velvets made without Lou.
Oh, really?
That was like ubiquitous for a very long time.
Squeeze.
Words just won't come, though I tried to write them, found I couldn't recite them.
I never bought that. I waited till it showed up on Spotify.
Oh, there you go.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me, Dean, you know, I want to get back to Live 69 because you were... If you're talking chronologically, you would have been in your teens when you bought this.
Yeah,
record,
I was 16 then when I bought it. Mm. Yeah, and I remember I would like play that record and make out with my girlfriend. There was all these sort of romantic songs like Lisa Says, Over You. So, I mean, two songs that were not had never been actually on any other Velvet Underground record either.
Mm-hmm. And there was early versions of some of the songs that ended up on Loaded, which came out the next year.
Right.
Lou Swan song. So it was interesting to hear those songs as they were being developed by that band.
It's a great introduction. The Matrix tapes, it fleshes that thing out, and sounds fantastic because it's remixed from four tracks. But the way this album is sequenced, it's just a great listen.
Well, and obviously the Velvets, a band that played a big role in your life, inspirational to Galaxy 500, forwarding really what the Velvets had done. And, you know, shout out to the tugboat captain, Sterling Morrison.
Yes, exactly.
First Galaxy single. So where are we going next, Dean?
Well, the next one I would have bought would be the Feelies album, Crazy Rhythms. And I remember I didn't buy that at Disco Matt. I bought it somewhere on like West 8th Street.
Yep, yep. That row of record stores and head shops, and when New York was New York.
And the Feelies had just been written up in the Village Voice, and I like the photo of them because they kind of look, they didn't look like punk rockers, they looked like nerds. They were like pleated pants and V-neck sweaters and had short hair and.
Like everybody you went to Harvard with. It's kind of what they look like.
Well, nice woolen pleated pant. I don't know. It's kind from the vintage store, not Dockers. But,
The Village Voice had called them the most important band in New York. And Crazy Rhythms is an album that they obsessed over, working with the sound man they met at CBGB, Mark Abel. But really, they produced it. I mean, the level of attention to detail on that record, sonically and also visually. You know what the back cover is a photo of? I just have so much trivia in my head about that album.
No.
It was Bill Million's mom's kitchen tile.
Oh, really?
That little bits and pieces and specks of color. You know, they were obsessed with that. And my favorite Feelies photo from that era shows them sitting at that kitchen table. And they each had these mugs, like clear, round Nescafe coffee mugs. And they gave me one. It was a little map of the world on a mug. And I was like, oh, that is so cool.
I hope you still have that.
But what was it about that album that caught you?
Well, you know what? I brought it home and I put it on and I was like, this isn't the Feelies. This is Elena Lovitch. Somehow the wrong record from Stiff Records had made its way, been packed. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So,
I had to go back to the store and be like, can you give me the correct record, please?
So, yeah.
But from the opening seconds of that record, it's the Boy with Perpetual Nervousness, which just fades up really slowly over like 45 seconds. And I was just hooked immediately.
And the claves, the sound of those echoed claves.
It's all about rhythm, and I'm not sure. It seems like even the drum parts are probably done like bit by bit, as opposed to someone sitting behind a kit and playing a drum kit. It feels like everything is percussion. The guitars are percussive, and they're playing like they're playing a coffee can. They're just, most pop or rock records, at a certain point, you get bored with them. There's nothing new to hear, but it's so layered and so arranged down to the last note.
There's a kid I know, but not too well. Doesn't have a lot to say. Well, this boy lives right next door, and he has nothing to say.
It is an amazing record. You know, Anton Fier played drums, and of course, Dave Weckerman, their longtime percussionist, all that stuff was recorded live. You know, the thing that was amazing is when they were playing, they were double the tempo live. And the story was that Bill Million and Glenn Mercer, the two guitarists, would sometimes so rev up the tempos that Anton would turn away from the audience and throw up physically behind the drum set. That they were so. Now, you, of course, wind up in Luna playing with Stanley Domeski, who took over the drummer's throne from Anton for all the other Feelies albums.
Yeah. The first time I saw them would have been 85 at Jonathan Swift's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And then I saw them at the Peppermint Lounge. They would only play on holidays. That was the whole thing. At least that was the rumor.
Holiday weekends. Yeah.
But yeah, it was Stanley on drums by that point.
Said it's time to go, all right. I don't want to go, I say, all right. Never listen to me anyway. Yo, so nothing much to say. New mommy on the TV show, that's all right, I watch it anyway. I don't talk much, it gets in my way. Let it get in the way. Do a job, we get things done. We work very hard, we get things done. Time to spare, not now. Can't relax, I got things to do. The big plans stay, the little ones fade. It's nice to know it's party lack.
One of the things that struck me, Dean, when you were talking about the Velvets, because my experience was similar to yours, I wanted to find out who the Velvets were, and I bought that record was the only one available, and I was blown away, obviously. And then you have a whole bunch of other records to explore once you discover that one and go back. But, you know, I read about those records. I read about the Velvet's record. I read about the Feelies record. It sounds like you had a similar experience where it wasn't so much you heard it, you heard about it, and then said, okay, well, this sounds like something I'd buy. I don't know, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know where I would have possibly heard those things. It wasn't like today where you can hear anything, check out anything you want before you go buy it. No, it's true.
Maybe WNYU radio, but that was about it back in those days.
Right.
Yeah, the only way I heard about the Velvets, the first way I heard about them was through, you know, the Lou Reed solo records, and we all had Rock and Roll Animal. So was I in for a surprise when I heard the Velvet Underground 69?
Yeah,
it didn't
completely
sound anything
different.
Like that. You know?
I think, yeah, my older brother had Rock and Roll Animal, too. He liked that, so.
Yeah, because the guitarist had played with Alice Cooper, so, yeah. You know.
All the metalheads yes. loved yeah. it.
Yes, it's that's an amazing record, too, but in a very different way.
Yeah.
Did the Feelies consciously, their image making of, we are consciously not going to pretend to be anybody we are. We are going to not dress up. We're nerds from the suburbs of New Jersey, and that's who we are. Did that influence Galaxy 500? Because, similarly, the three of you with Damon and Naomi as your partners, I mean, there was no pretense or no look or no image making, really, to Galaxy.
Yeah.
The album covers were beautiful, but yeah. You know, when we saw you, you know, you were three guys.
Mm.
Yeah, well, we tried to dress up. I mean, I would almost argue that with Crazy Rhythms that they are dressing up, that they, you know, but...
Well, yeah, but knowing those guys for four decades, they always look like that.
Oh, really? Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, that's just, really, you know, on a right. Sunday morning, that's what Glenn looked like, yeah.
Well, I mean, we tried to look nice, but in photo shoots, we tried to put on, shirt with a collar. And actually, that's not even true. We wore T-shirts. You know what? Mostly through the 90s, as an indie band, you weren't supposed to... I feel like this goes in kind of waves, but you weren't supposed to dress up in the...
Yeah, yeah.
In the 90s, yeah. You're supposed to dress down.
Yeah, you don't
at least for American bands.
Yeah.
You know, it's always different.
Brits are always more fashion conscious.
Yeah.
So those are Dean Wareham's first two albums that made him. Coming up, we're going to hear about some Brits and a modern lover who also made a big impact on him. That's coming up on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Today we're talking with Dean Wareham of Galaxy 500, Luna and Dean and Britta, about the five albums that made him. Let's hear what album number three was.
Sandinista, the great Clash triple album. I wanted to be Joe Strummer. For a little while, there was a slogan back then, the only band that matters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't quite believe that. Other bands mattered too, but... I saw them on tour right when that album came out. I don't know if you were at one of those shows, Jim's, at Bonds.
The Bonds, Bonds was an old men's clothing store that had shut down.
Those are legendary shows.
Yeah, legendary shows. It was amazing. It blew my mind. In the heart of Times Square.
Yeah. So they announced six shows, and then I think I was at the first show, and the fire department then shut them down for overselling mm-hmm. the shows. So then they had to play 12 shows to honor all mm-hmm. all the tickets. Get up and learn those rules. When the man and the crazy chief, one says son and one says see.
AM and FM, the PM too. Turning out that boogaloo. Gets you up and I guess you out. But how long can you keep it up? Give me Honda, give me Sony. So cheap and real phony. Hong Kong dollar, Indian cents, English pounds and Eskimo pence.
It's a great political album. It's full of all these political songs, but I saw Grandmaster Flash open for them. I mentioned this in my book. And it turned ugly. It was like they were basically booed off the stage with racist chants and people giving them the finger. And when Joe Strummer came out, he looked horrified by that. It's a sprawling mess of an album. I guess it's a New York album, and you can make an argument that the Clash at that point were a New York band. Just like
they certainly spent a lot of time there.
Yeah.
Cotton and I have a fundamental disagreement, Dean. I have never liked Sandinista, despite seeing him at that point, despite being a huge fan, and it just because of the sprawl of it. And Greg's always gone to bat for it. So turn me around. Well, it just seemed, it's like my problem with, you know, the Grateful Dead catalog, say. There was just so much of it and so few rewarding moments sprinkled throughout.
Well, I agree. They don't have the songs that the Clash do. I don't know. I would just go look. Lose This Skin, which is, that's Ellen Foley singing that.
Meatloaf's duet partner, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously there's some filler on it. You've got, you know, a little children's choir singing Career Opportunities.
Yeah, which was much better on the first album.
Yes.
Said I better take everything they got. Do you want to make tea at the BBC? Do you want to be, do you really want to be a cop? Career Opportunities.
You could say there was filler on Exile on Main Street too. That's what I would say. It's like it's kind of like interstitial. It's like, you know, it's part of the journey on this record. And Dean, you said you saw those Bond shows, so you know, and the Grandmaster Flash, they were hugely influenced by that stuff. And this record was bringing all those kind of non-rock influences into their music, so I think they wanted to showcase that.
Yeah, and then they were expanding beyond what punk was thought of, I guess. What was allowed? I saw them at Palladium too. I saw them earlier, but actually, I saw the cover of London Calling is that image of Paul Simonon with a bass guitar, like throwing it on the, and I was at that one too. But
wow.
Yeah,
I mean, they were galvanizing live band, no doubt about it.
Yes, I go back. I read the New York Times review of that the show at Bonds, and he said like Joe Strummer can't sing. He's got the range of three blind mice. I'm like, well, that may be true.
yeah,
but so what?
Yeah, and bad diction.
Yes,
Joe was a bit of a mumbler, but that's because his teeth before he got his teeth.
Except
fixed.
When he was pissed off, then he would really. He was like Chuck D. It was kind of like, you know. Bullhorn stuff, you know.
About, yeah, what an inspiring human being he was, and it's that was a sad day when he left this world at what age?
There's a fine
something.
Documentary about him too. Have you seen that?
Yes, by Julian Temple, right?
Yes, Julian Temple. Yeah. There's a lot of love in that film.
So I don't know how it shaped me. Actually, it's funny because I look back and like, you know, yes, you won't really hear the Clash in any of the music I've made, but it encouraged. The songs just had a few chords in them, and they sort of, that's where I, you know, in Galaxy 500, the pre-Galaxy 500 band was Speedy and the Castanets, and we used to do the Clash song, We're a Garage Band.
We're a garage band.
And we did Police and Thieves too, so So it's a band that influenced me to pick up an instrument, let's put it that way.
Well, and I think the concern for fans and the notion of operating ethically, even if you're on Epic Records and, you know, you're rocking the Casbah and having a big hit at one point, they were still always the Clash. You know,
yeah.
Strummer never compromised.
I think I think he really suffered for that, because I think the press were really, especially the English press, were really hard on him, and he was just—it's held to a higher standard than anyone else. And in a way, say like maybe like Spike Lee is sometimes when they ask Spike Lee, "Well, oh yeah, you're going to donate some of the money to this or that cause," and he's like, "What? Would you ask that of Martin Scorsese? Give me a break."
Yeah.
So he felt like a crushing weight of, I guess, the weight that comes from being the only band that matters.
Yeah.
Well, Dean, you mentioned that you'd seen him before this era. I remember seeing the London Calling show at the Aragon in Chicago. You know, they had so much cred, you know, with that record. It was just like this acclaimed masterpiece, right? London Calling. And
yeah.
I think what struck me about Sandinista was that it was this complete left turn. Like, nobody was really expecting them that this record was going to be made by them. And that was like, wow. That really made me pay attention more than anything. It was just so different. I admit the first few times I listened to it, I was like completely like, what the hell? You know? And it grew on me to the point where I really appreciate it now for what it is, which is, you know, to me, it was like an amazing statement about what the 80s were going to be, like this kind of mixing and matching of cultures, you know, the way hip-hop did, you know? They almost presaged that from a rock perspective.
So what is it 80? Is it 80, 81? But I feel like that's a great period for music and just the sound of it. And I think New Order to what Talking Heads were doing right then, with Remain in Light and what the Clash were doing too. Listen to, say, LCD Sound System. I think they actually sound like they come out of that particular year, sometimes anyway.
Yeah. It's interesting how much New York we're talking about. I think people forget, Greg, you know, Dean went to Harvard, you know, Galaxy Forms in Cambridge, but you were working at the Bops Library at NYU and spending more time in New York in that era, really, than up in New York.
Yeah, at least half my time, yeah, because my girlfriend lived there. Yeah.
We're going to a New Englander next, Jonathan Richman. I think a lot of fans of yours would be surprised that we get to album number 4 before we talk about Richman.
And I've chosen an album that's apparently out of print. I didn't realize it's not on Spotify.
What does out of print even mean these days, though? You know, everything's on the net somewhere.
Yes, you'll find it. Rockin' and Romance. Yeah, somebody's put it up on YouTube for you. What do I love about John? Well, it's another Velvet influence artist, obviously, and he's so good in the new movie.
He is, yeah.
Yeah, he is a very eloquent voice.
At that time when we were making the Galaxy 500 records, he's someone we were like discovering at that point it was the late Jonathan Richman records. Now I guess those are like early to mid period Jonathan Richman records, like Back in Your Life and Modern Lovers Live. And Rockin' and Romance. I probably could have picked any of those, but I love him as a guitar player, actually. It's what I really enjoy. And he's someone who, he's gotten better. He's such a good player now. But when he's playing his guitar solos, he never strays too far from the melody, which is kind of...
Yeah, kind of like Neil Young in that way.
Yeah. So anyway, we went and saw him. We had done a cover of... His Don't Let Our Youth Go to Waste.
On those days, and I could drink off everything you have. Don't let our youth go to waste. Or
really a rearrangement of it. We probably could have taken some songwriting credit, but we didn't. And we went and saw him at Night Stage in Cambridge. He was playing a show, and we gave him a copy of our record. We said, well, we based this cover on. He's like, I know where you got it from. He's like, so Kim Thowley is a very nice man, but he's also a liar. And because he had released these demos without Richmond's.
Which are Richmond's excellent approval. Recordings. But yeah, yes, everyone who ever has dealt with Kim Thowley had said that sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And I could drink up everything you have. Don't let our youth go to waste.
But I first got into the Modern Lovers again in high school, maybe from the Sex Pistols, from the Great Rock and Roll Swindle, because the Sex Pistols do a cover of Roadrunner. I think that's the first time I heard about the Modern Lovers, and I was like, what's this? And I got to find this record, and you could not find that record. But I found a copy in New Zealand where it was still in print. When I would go back there some summers, and I managed to get a copy of it there.
Well, you know, it's interesting, especially in this mid-period Richmond, the vulnerability and the sort of naivete and the 100% hard-on-the-sleeve attitude, you know, especially in the early Galaxy days, but it's a thread that also runs through Dean and Britta and the new album, I Have Nothing to Say to the Mayor of L.A. You know, you're not afraid to sometimes talk to us like a 13-year-old, awkward with life.
Right,
in an endearing way, Dean.
Yeah, so thank you.
I challenged myself to a duel yesterday. I carried a lock of your hair. I insulted myself. I counted to 12. We fired 3 shots in the air. It's a gay parade. She's above my pay grade. I feel like I've taken first prize.
The other thing about Jonathan Richmond is he'll write a song about a chewing gum wrapper, right? I found a chewing gum wrapper.
Yeah.
And I think that's where poetry is in lyrics, too, is in details like that.
Everyday, common things.
Little
right?
things.
Tread a little chewing gum wrapper, faded by the rain. Plenty and corroded some. I started chewing gum wrapper. I picked it up just like a bum.
In fact, that's kind of punk too, in a way. It's like punk is a celebration of the ugly or the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that was kind of different about this record, I mean, Jonathan always kind of varied the palette a little bit, even though he was essentially Jonathan in every record. You know, he was like playing a role on Jonathan Richmond as Jonathan Richmond.
Yes.
Is the doo-wop harmonies on this record?
Yes.
You know, that was kind of like, whoa, where did that come from?
Yeah, well, I wonder where he discovers doo-wop, if he discovers it through the Velvet Underground. Obviously, he was a massive fan. He followed them around. But yeah, the songs, the Baltimores, the nonsense rhyming. I borrowed, he sings somewhere, nimni, nimni, nimni. He'll sing wang-a-dang-a-dang-a-ding-a-dang-dang, ba-boom-ba-boom-ba-doom.
Baltimore's, the Baltimore's. There's a band that can make me shout. The Baltimore's, oh, they knock me out.
I use that Nimni Nimni in a Luna song, Moon Palace. That's from Jonathan Richmond.
Oh, yeah. That's where that comes from. Okay.
Nimni 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 Wah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's nice to just inject a little silliness.
Well,
there's a romantic aspect to it. Lou Reed had that too, that he loved that
love,
you know,
the
overly sentimental music. And Jonathan, it just absolutely lavishes his record in that.
Yeah. Well, he details, like, in the song Down in Bermuda, he details what happened to him. Because you always hear these stories like, what if that first Modern Lovers record had come out when it was supposed to, it would have changed the history of rock and roll instead of it sort of got buried. But part of the problem was, I think, that Jonathan himself refused to promote that record. That he, right. In fact, when he came back to finish the record, he didn't even want to sing those songs. He's like, no, I've been to Bermuda and I've like had a revelation that like my old personality is all wrong. This like angry, dark guy is wrong, and this is the new sweet me, and I'm going to sing songs about insects and how, yep. how and my positive attitude.
Down in Bermuda, I realized how stiff I'd been. I didn't want to be like that more again in Bermuda.
And the famous quote was, you know, he didn't want the shows to be loud enough to hurt a baby's ears. That was why he unplugged. I don't want to hurt any children who
right.
might be here, babies in particular.
Kramer told me the story of that Shockabilly opened for Jonathan Richman once. And that Jonathan Richman came over to Eugene Chadbourne after soundcheck. He's like, no, it's too loud. I would want my grandmother to be able to listen to this show. And Chadbourne said, well, my grandmother wouldn't be caught dead listening to your music. That's the story as it was told. Whether or not he said that, I don't know.
Yikes.
I easy laugh. I easy cry.
Coming up, we'll hear about Dean's final album that made him, and we'll hear from you, the listeners. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, alotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This week, we're talking with Dean Wareham about five albums that made him. Let's hear his final pick.
I'm going to go with Movement by New Order, the first New Order album.
Making Mr. Cott very happy over there.
Oh, really?
The choice. Yeah, I love New Order.
Brilliant album. The interesting thing is that they hate it. They don't like this album.
Right.
I think sometimes, when you're the artist, part of it is you remember the pain that went into making it, maybe. And it seems like it was an unpleasant experience. And at that point, they had soured on Martin Hannett, the producer. But it all seems kind of childish to me to like gripe about Martin Hannett and what he made them do, because he's brilliant. And he's the fifth member of that band. He's part of what makes that record sound so good.
I'm
It's recorded so soon after Ian Curtis's suicide.
Yeah, I think that was the biggest factor in making it an unpleasant experience, is how do you move on from that?
Yes, over. You're right. Yeah.
Dean, I got to say, it was an interesting choice, one New Order fan to another, because this record often gets overlooked. A lot of people talk about it as a transition between Joy Division and what New Order became, and Temptation was kind of like the signpost song for the new
right,
order.
For the next band. Yeah.
So
yeah, this one's closer to Joy Division.
It is, without Ian's vocals, you know, and I guess the other thing that's interesting about this record to me is that Bernard, they didn't really know who the vocalist was going to be. So Peter Hook and Bernard Sumner were sort of trading off vocals. I think Hook actually sings lead on a couple of the songs here. You can tell the vocals sound a little tentative because they're not sure who's going to do this.
Yeah,
job, I mean, or even if they want to do it.
There's video footage of them playing at Hurrah in New York, because they came over again like 4 months after Ian Curtis. And there's video footage, and I don't know which song it is, where they take turns singing within the song. Each of them takes turns. But yeah, they have not figured it out at all.
Yeah, but I suppose that makes it more vulnerable in some ways.
Yeah.
More human.
Yeah.
So their live radio performances from around this period are pretty great too. Before they get so heavily into sequencing that it becomes difficult for them to play the songs, mm-hmm. the other stuff, mm-hmm. without a computer.
Right. You know, the thing about the early synth stuff was that Sumner invented a lot of those instruments. They were kind of like homemade. He wasn't buying them off the shelf anywhere. He was kind of making stuff, you know,
right.
gadgets. And it sounded crude by the standards of most electronic music of that era, and that's what I really love about it. Like the first version of Temptation, I thought was just amazing for that reason.
I think the same was probably true of Kraftwerk. It was difficult for them to play live because what they were doing in the studio was so meticulous, yeah. and building these sounds, maybe creating them from samples or their own homemade instruments, that when it came to doing them live, it was not possible until about 30 years later, and then it became easier.
So sequencers.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing to watch. You just hit the button.
Your Aphex Twin, you're sitting lounging on a couch pressing a button, right? That's amazing.
Well, that is a heck of a playlist, Dean. And I have nothing to say to the mayor of LA. It came out in October last year. But, of course, the world was shut down. Are you planning on touring now with it? Or
I have planned a few shows. I just played San Francisco. I'm playing Los Angeles, touring Europe in July. A tour that has been postponed 3 times, but it's... I think it's finally going to happen. I hope we get through it.
Well, get boosted, get double boosted.
I will. And, I'm going to do that before I go.
And wear your mask.
Thank you, Dr. DeRogatis.
Well, I'm talking to myself as much as anything.
Yeah.
All right. It's been an absolute pleasure, Dean. And
thank you for having me.
We will not go decades again before we have you back.
Yeah, nice to see you again.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dean.
Maybe my dreams were childish dreams. Maybe my songs remain unfinished. Maybe my flights were flights of fancy. I'm not selling out, I'm cashing in. I can't.
That wraps up our conversation with the always interesting Dean Wareham. And now we want to hear from you. What 5 albums would you choose to tell the story of your life? Leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. We got some new technology there. Or find a link in our show notes. Now, let's hear some of those messages from you, our listeners.
New messages. Hey, this is Kevin from Salt Lake. There's this album called Religion from a band called Howard that I stumbled upon, I think, through Spotify. Blows my mind a little bit. Elements of Radiohead. It seems like a little bit of a buried treasure. I'm not sure if they're an independent band or what. The song Falling is fun. Check it out. Falling, yeah.
Hi, Jim and Greg. This is Kip from Philadelphia. I love the show, and I'm catching up on some recent episodes. I wonder if I can ask a question. I'd love to hear you reflect on why it's not okay for Drake to sample R. Kelly in his recent album. You panned him for that. But it is okay for you all to do a whole episode on how you love Led Zeppelin, even though they did some pretty heinous things in their heyday. And you played some of their music on that episode. It feels dissonant to me, and I would love to hear you reflect on that. Thanks very much.
Hey guys, this is John from Evanston, calling about episode 849. Yeah, I know, it's a long time ago, but I just heard it, loved it. It's one of my favorite episodes of all time. I just wanted to name check a couple of bands that you might think about. Blue Aeroplanes from Bristol, UK, really popular in the late 80s. Song What It Is from Swagger is particularly great. Great poet and vocalist, Gerard Langley. And then Andy White from Ireland or Northern Ireland, and some great songs from the same era. Love it. I think Religious Persuasion is probably my favorite chant-like song from the late 80s also. But love the show. Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
Should have packed my bags, headed off for the coast. Had my time already come to meet the heavenly host. They switched on their halos, adjusted their harps, checked that the blades on the pearly gates were sharp. I asked them what they meant about religious bent. They said, that's the test I said, that's the test I meant. They were given holy orders, I think you'll find. I was up against persuasion of their religious...
Hello, I would like to submit my favorite question songs. It's Men at Work, Who Can It Be Now? And I think it's a great song that talks about obsessing about like one particular element in one's life and to become self-reflective in order to, you know, kind of work your way out of that particular obsession. It's timeless because it talks about mental health coming out of, you know, COVID. I think that that's always a great topic to discuss.
Best out if you hang outside.
Hey, Sound Opinions team, this is Elizabeth calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. When I heard the theme of songs that pose questions, two that I adore came to mind, one right after the other. First, there's Who Loves the Sun by the Velvet Underground.
Who loves the sun? Who cares that it makes plants grow? Who cares what it does since you broke my heart?
Then there is Barrier Reef by the Old 97s.
What's so great about the Barrier Reef? What's so fine about art? What's so good about a good time span? When you're working on a broken, working on a broken, working on a
Both songs question the value of generally adored phenomena to convey heartache and brokenness. Who Loves the Sun sings Doug Yule, Since You Broke My Heart, "What's so great about the Barrier Reef?" demands Rhett Miller when you're working on a broken man. For the Velvet Underground, who loves the sun, is unusually tame, simple stuff, musically and lyrically. I'm not even sure I buy the broken heart of the singer. Yule's vocals at once add and remove a layer of irony. But I love the accessibility.
No more messages.
Thank you to everyone who left us a message. If you want to let us know your opinions, leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what have we got on the show next week?
Great stuff next week, Jim. John Doe, one of the co-founders of the great LA punk band X, is going to dissect their classic album Under the Big Black Sun with us.
Yeah!
And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast, where this week I added a song by another New Zealander to the Desert Island Jukebox.
I would have loved to have been in New Zealand when all that great music was happening. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cox.